Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro. Welcome to For Women Over 40. Today I'll be talking with two women who have experienced pregnancy loss about this very subject. Amy Wright Glenn earned her MA at Teachers College, Columbia University. She is a birthing mama, prenatal yoga and wellness teacher trainer, Kripalu yoga teacher, doula, hospital chaplain, and author of the wonderful book, Birth, Breath, and Death, Meditations on Motherhood, Chaplaincy, and Life as a Doula. Amy is an active contributor to Philly Voice, and her work has appeared in Holistic Parenting magazine. Elizabeth Petricelli is an author, bereavement doula, and childbirth educator. After the loss of her second child in 2010, Elizabeth left the field of law enforcement in order to serve women and families experiencing pregnancy loss and any gestation. She is an active blogger, public speaker, and hosts workshops for birth professionals on how to support families through pregnancy loss. She personally serves families through the loss of their baby through the Denver metro area. Elizabeth lost her fourth child to miscarriage in May 2015. She lives in Parker, Colorado with her husband of 17 years and their two sons. Welcome, Amy and Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
This is a painful topic. I think it will be painful for me on the receiving end. I'm sure it's very painful for you on the giving end. And I'd like to just get a little bit of information about your journey and interest in the topic. Amy, tell me a little bit more about your personal passion.
Sure. Thank you so much for welcoming me to your show, Sima. I am a trained birth doula and hospital chaplain, and I've always been interested in holding sacred space for life events. And really, birth and death are the most definitive and most powerful life events, I believe, in the human story, how we enter this world and how we leave this world. And when death happens so close to birth or even before the physical birth, it's a moving and difficult place because these threshold points suddenly are turned. Usually they go in order, now they're turned in a different order that's outside of the normative human life cycle. So as a hospital chaplain, I've been with families through pregnancy loss and stillbirth, and I have a very deep place in my heart for wanting to speak clearly and compassionately around this type of loss, too often treated as taboo, and I'm grateful you welcome me here to share reflections on this subject.
And Elizabeth, I've talked a little bit about your personal story, but what remains your passion in reaching out to other women in this subject?
I was treated dramatically differently between both of my miscarriages. My first miscarriage was basically just treated as a medical event and not anything that I should grieve over emotionally, just maybe the physical aspect of things. And then with my second miscarriage, I was treated compassionately with great empathy, and I received support from my care provider in having a final resting place for my child and naming my child, and that helped me to cope and move forward much more quickly. And so that is my passion, is to help women through pregnancy loss and help them to cope better so that they're not feeling stuck on certain things. Certain things we tend to get stuck on, such as how a care provider treated us, and that keeps us from moving forward. And so that is my passion, to help them to cope.
Before we continue, I think it's important to differentiate between the situations of pregnancy loss. So can one or both of you address what is a miscarriage, and are there different types of miscarriages? And then again, how is miscarriage different than stillbirth? Amy?
Well, I know that in the UK and in the US, there's a difference in terms of the weeks. And I know Elizabeth and I've communicated about this in the past. The miscarriage is 20 weeks and less in the US, from what I understand. Elizabeth, is that right? In the UK, it's 24 weeks and less. That's how they term it?
Yes. So pregnancy loss up to 20 weeks gestation is considered miscarriage in the US and 24 weeks in the UK.
Right. So it's really just a matter of determining how old the fetus is at the time of death. And often what's happened, I think, is that miscarriage is much more common than stillbirth, but when for pregnancies and in miscarriage, whereas stillbirth, it's about 1 in 140, if I remember correctly. So what happens, I think, is that because miscarriage is more common and it happens earlier, there's a sense that somehow the grief would be for individual women less than a stillbirth, and that's definitely not always the case. I think it's important when we speak of pregnancy loss to honor both of the situations where when we have fetal demise or a loss of a pregnancy or the death of a baby right at term, and to make sure that women who've experienced any of these events are included under the umbrella of pregnancy loss, and that their stories are given credit for mattering in the lives of these women, and they get to determine how they understand that loss. And a lot of supporting women is following their lead, letting the family and the mother really lead us as supporters and caregivers to mentor and support and uplift and just listen to the meaning, whether it is a miscarriage or a stillbirth.
And to address the different types of miscarriage, there are several different types of miscarriage. Chemical pregnancy is one of them, which can occur around the time a woman would miss her period, so she might receive a positive pregnancy test, and then maybe the next day or so take another pregnancy test and it would be negative. We have blighted ovum, which is where the gestational sac develops but no embryo develops. That can complicate grief in that women might feel like they weren't really pregnant even though they had a pregnancy test that was positive. And then we have kind of just the regular, what we all assume is miscarriage, which is death of the baby while in the womb. We have live miscarriage, which occurs when the baby is born alive but is too young for medical intervention. Ectopic pregnancy, where the baby implants outside of the uterus, which most commonly is within the fallopian tube, and that can be fatal for the mother and the baby. And then there are some variations, such as molar and partial molar pregnancy, where an error occurs during meiosis, which results in cancerous tissue forming, and sometimes partial or the formation of an embryo or fetus. And all of those can kind of compound or complicate grief based on what they're being told, women are being told by their care providers and where they kind of feel life may begin.
And talk about stillbirth.
Stillbirth is defined as the death of a baby after 20 weeks gestation.
Do you have any stats for number of women in the country who experience this?
So 1 in 160 women in the U.S. or 1 in 160 pregnancies will end in stillbirth. In the U.K., it's 1 in 200.
And I think the first thing that strikes me is the amount of internal shame that so many of these women must feel, that they're failures as women. Can you address that, Amy?
This is the work, really, of chaplaincy and the training that we received in the hospital to be a support for families through death, through trauma. I think there's a sense not only of failure as a woman, perhaps even more intensely, is the loss of a dream and the sense that I was connected to this baby and I was nurturing this baby, my body was a home for this child, and suddenly that shifted. And I've been with mothers who are holding little ones who've died and just weeping tears of confusion and loss and grief, and the intense emotions are amplified by a body that is carrying the hormonal pattern to nurture life. And so I just wrote an article for Philly Voice for a mother who delivered her child at 20 weeks and he had died in utero. And then her care providers, and I think Elizabeth's so right on about noticing how care providers present information and offer support or not to a mother who's in bereavement, her care provider said, "We won't lactate, it's too early." But just a few days after the birth, she had her breast engorged with milk, and her doctor said, "Bind up your breast and take Sudafed, and the milk will dry up." And it just felt so counterintuitive, and this is a mom who didn't know about donating milk to milk banks or the need for milk for premature babies. She lived in a small town up in northern Maine, and this was all new, but she trusted this intuition that led her to pump. And it felt, she said, like a healing to pump the milk and to notice that she suddenly felt close to her son, who she had named Bryson. And she felt a real deep connection as she pumped milk. And then researching, finding that there is a milk bank that would accept her milk, and they overnighted it. And for 8 months, she pumped over 92 gallons, or just slightly under 92 gallons of milk. I think that's an example of where a mom may be able to heal some of that sense of the loss of womanhood or motherhood. When the baby has died and we're dealing with such a painful wound, there are ways where the body, which has been prepped to nurture, may find healing physically and emotionally, spiritually, in offering the milk that would have gone to support the life of that baby, to enrich the babies that are premature, who are struggling, and where formula wouldn't be a healthy option, in particular for little ones. So I hope that's a helpful story where there is a sense of deep loss, but there also can be for some women a healing when they listen to their physical and emotional intuition.
Elizabeth?
Shame, I think society kind of pushes that shame. And even though I know what I know now that I'm a certified bereavement doula, I still felt very shameful after I lost my little Gus in May. Even knowing that sex doesn't cause miscarriage, eating certain ways doesn't cause miscarriage, you still kind of feel it's your fault, so you feel kind of shameful towards that. And then your grief can be compounded, and when you try to express that grief to other people who may not understand, then you feel ashamed of even expressing that grief. And I see that a lot with women who experience blighted ovum, in that they're kind of confused. Do I have a baby? Was it really a baby? I'm not really sure it's a baby, but I feel immense grief over this baby. And if someone says, well, it wasn't really a baby, then they feel very shameful for even expressing those feelings. And women just kind of need to be validated with their feelings. And it is a loss of a dream. Amy kind of hit the nail on the head with that. It is a loss of a dream, whether we have this physical baby or not. And women with infertility experience that almost monthly when they pee on the stick and there's no positive pregnancy test. It's almost like a monthly miscarriage every single time they've lost that dream. And they do feel shame because society doesn't necessarily accept that as a valid grief experience.
So, Elizabeth, what are some of the steps you'd suggest for women who find themselves in this situation?
I think all women should have the support of a mentor or a bereavement doula, whether they're going through infertility challenges, whether they're experiencing pregnancy loss. They need someone, some person that understands all of the options and understands the experiences, both physical and emotional, that can help them work through all of the aspects of that experience.
And Amy?
I will highlight the work of a man named Alan Wolfett. He's the gentleman who founded an organization that I really draw strength from. He's the founder at the Center for Loss and Life Transition. And he's termed a philosophy called companioning. And this is different than the idea of kind of a treating people in grief, which had been the previous model that he had inherited, you know, where we treat people in grief to help them overcome their grief or fix the grief. But his work is companioning care, which where we, instead of treating, we companion, we anchor ourselves in this teach me perspective, and we listen and journey with the person in grief. And I admire the work of two RN out in Indianapolis, two women who work with pregnancy loss, and they've applied Alan Wolfett's idea of companioning in their hospital programs and with great success. And in fact, wrote a beautiful book entitled Companioning at a Time of Perinatal Loss. And for me, when I think of holding space and what women need, what families need at this time, it's individual. And it's really about coming shoulder to shoulder and really even taking a back seat and listening to a family process. And they may need to tell the story many times as they process. As a hospital chaplain, I've always been in the front line of emotional triage. You're right there, right when it happened, with the child, with the mother in the hospital room. And that work is very much walking into a room with a gentle, soft willingness to sit with deep pain and to be present to that and not try to just fix it model, but really an absorbing energy just to take it in and to reflect, to hold space, to pray. If the woman and family would like to pray, whatever tradition they come from, we're skilled at offering space for that. And just to listen to the grief, the tears. So what people need, which I believe, and Elizabeth said it clearly, the companioning model, whether it's trained bereavement doula, a chaplain, a close family friend who can hold that sacred space. We do well in human experience when we process grief with each other in a way that's accepting and open. And this is a painful grief, and this is a loss. I've experienced chemical pregnancy loss when Elizabeth listed the different types of miscarriage. Personally, that's my experience. And I just remember feeling very tender at that time and hopeful that I would be pregnant again with the next cycle. And just this tenderness is something that we can make space for by being present to each other.
So, Elizabeth, I'm taking this new model to be exactly that, a new model, because I think that for many of us growing up, whenever we knew of someone who experienced this type of loss, we would always try to do something to fix it for them, to give or make or do something for them. Is this kind of a newer train of thought?
I don't think so. I think we've kind of lost some of that because families are spread all over the place now. When we had tight-knit family units, we would support women, families, mothers in the ways that we're doing it now. I think because many women can't even call their mom to come down and help them just be with them through these experiences because they live in a completely different state. So the mentor or family friend, bereavement doula, chaplain, those women or members who want to fit in that can slide in and fit in that space and be that person, just like Amy was kind of talking about. So I don't think it's really new, although everyone who I talk to about being a bereavement doula says, wow, that's new. I've never heard of that before. Doulas in general have been around for thousands and thousands of years. So I don't think it's new. I just think we're kind of bringing back something that everyone deserves.
Sure. So when you're counseling the support system around a woman, what are some of the things that you counsel the partner, the family, the friends not to say or not to do? Amy?
That's a great question, because people really want to be helpful. And I think people really say things thinking they are helpful. You know, it's very, very rare where someone would purposely try to say something harmful in such a tender place. I think what could be unhelpful would be cliched responses like, oh, well, you'll have another baby, or, oh, there's a reason for everything. And I think you would need to know the mother well enough, know her, you know, religious, philosophical perspective well enough before these type of well-known phrases might work for her. So if she believes in a God energy or some type of religious afterlife, then phrases relating to that may actually be very helpful. But if you're unsure of that, you know, you don't know, best to just say something like, tell me more. Tell me more. I brought dinner. Let me hold your hand. Tell me more. Rather than, oh, there's a reason for everything, or, oh, you'll have another baby, or, oh, let's not make such a big deal. You're so healthy. You're so young, or you have other children who are living. I think those things can be very harmful, even when the mother said with great love. So I hope the listeners are getting is that there are best practices, just like with any field, teaching or medicine or doula work or law, in any field of human endeavor, we can study with our best intellect and heart at work and look at best practices and say what has been proven to be wise in this field. And in the field of bereavement care, it's wise to stay away from cliches and to be present to the heart of the person and to listen to the story with patients again and again if needed.
Elizabeth, what are some of the greatest misconceptions about women in this type of experience?
A couple of things come to mind. First, women are kind of told that miscarriage will be like a heavy period. And while that may be true for pregnancy loss occurring around the woman's expected period, many women beyond 6 weeks describe their miscarriage as extremely painful, having contractions, something very similar to labor. So explaining to women the true experience, the physical experience of miscarriage, will greatly help with their coping and understanding of what their body is going through. And the second would be that pregnancy loss is not common, especially stillbirth. I teach childbirth education classes, and I always talk about the subject, especially stillbirth. And everyone thinks, oh, it's something that happened in the olden days, hundreds of years ago. Babies don't die now. And we already mentioned the statistics of 1 in 160. That's way more common than some of the common worries and anxieties that we women have during our pregnancies when it comes to what might happen with the baby and how that baby's developing. And then the third is that pregnancy loss is not a big deal, and it's not worthy of grief. And this forces women to grieve in silence. When many women do reach out, they learn their friends and family members who have had those experiences, but they also remain silent. So there's this silent club that nobody knows about until you experience the pregnancy loss. And I know that not everyone would like to share and talk about their pregnancy loss, and that is completely okay. But there are many women who need that support and prefer not to be silent. So it's easy to silence someone, and that can come in the form of, especially when we're talking about social media now, reporting pictures of their stillborn babies on social media such as Facebook as inappropriate. Another example of silencing is that story that just came out about the school teacher that told the little boy that he needed to change his family picture, which included his stillborn brother in it, to a picture that did not have his stillborn brother in it. That just completely silences the entire family. So refusing to say the baby's name, refusing to attend a memorial service or funeral service, pretending like nothing happened, wanting the family to be normal again, and pushing the family to stop crying and grieving are all ways to silence their grief and their loss. So there are many misconceptions, but those are probably the three or four that come to mind.
So you told me a little bit about the stats regarding numbers of miscarriages and stillbirths in this country. Are these numbers on the rise? Are they staying the same?
So there's been a slight increase in miscarriages over the past 15 years, but also an increase of older mothers becoming pregnant. Age of the mother does increase the likelihood of pregnancy loss, And the use of IVF also increases the risk of stillbirth, and many older mothers utilize IVF. So the UK reports that miscarriage occurs before 24 weeks gestation and occurs in about 1 in 6 pregnancies. And when we mentioned their stillbirth rate, in the UK is 1 in 200 compared to the US, which is 1 in 160. So it is on the rise. It kind of fluctuates. Definitely 30, 40 years ago, the rates were much higher than they are now, but they're still pretty high.
Some of the organization that I turn to when I think about the global question around pregnancy loss and even maternal health, the loss of a mother through pregnancy and birth, is the organization Every Mother Counts as a nonprofit. And what they do is they work diligently to make pregnancy safe for every mother, pregnancy and childbirth safe for every mother. Of course, emphasis is in Every Mother Counts on the mother surviving experience, because in many countries, women still have very high rates of maternal death. And they do also track the stats, you know, in terms of change over the decades, and looking at the UN, you could say their goal is to try to decrease maternal death. So that's an organization for listeners, if they're interested outside of the U.S., to think in terms of the health and survival of infant and mother, or baby and mother. This is an organization I would recommend research.
The topic of women over 40 getting pregnant has become a very prevalent conversation in this country, and it doesn't look like this phenomenon, which is what they originally termed it 10 years ago, is going away anytime soon. On the other hand, there is that risk of any numbers of things potentially happening in a negative way. Can either of you address this?
I can speak to it personally. I'm 42. I had my first child when I was 38. I would love to conceive and have one more child before too long. And it's something I think about often in terms of women waiting to choose motherhood when they enter their late 30s and 40s. I think about this often. I reflect on it. There's some interesting reading to do. That's what drew me to your work. And it's a topic that's very much alive. I just read recently in the UK for the first time, when since they've taken and keeping track of the ages of mothers at birth, the first time ever, statistics shows that women over, I think it was 38, the mothers entering for the first baby, 38 and over, is higher than it is 25 and younger.
Right.
And that's the first time. So that's a big shift, and I don't think it is just a passing phenomenon. It's a change culturally for developing countries.
It sure is. It is in itself forcing medical technologies to keep up with it, vis-a-vis medical technologies are being forced to have to address all of these situations. Would you agree, Elizabeth?
Oh, absolutely. I turned 40 in a couple of weeks, and I was pregnant with Gus in May, and he was to be delivered where his due date was yesterday. And my care provider, the entire 10 to 12 weeks of pregnancy they had, kept saying, we're going to deliver your baby by 39 weeks to prevent stillbirth. And I know that many women over 40, I'm a part of many groups of women over 40, and they all struggle with that. Why am I having this forced medical intervention? I don't necessarily understand it. How do I cope with it? How do I get around it? How do I not feel anxious about it if I choose to go farther than 39 weeks? And what options are there for me to protect myself from stillbirth beyond 38, 39, 40 weeks? I definitely agree that doctors are, you know, attempting to lower stillbirth rate in that way, and the increase in intervention is due partly because we don't know a whole lot about women over 40 having successful live birth outcomes. It's just not, it wasn't as common as it is now.
What ancillary support services might women take advantage of, such as support groups, therapy, creative outlets? Amy, do you have thoughts about that?
Yes, I do. It's certainly, larger hospitals in particular will have bereavement programs, not only for bereavement in general, but specific to perinatal loss. If I can recommend a source of support, I would highly recommend wherever the hospital that's closest to a listener who would need the support, you know, contact their pastoral care department and see if they have a bereavement program, or contact their labor and delivery or the head nurse in charge of labor and delivery and see what options they have. I have worked with a mom as a doula who had a stillbirth of twins at the 8th month, and she did a lot of therapy in preparation for her second pregnancy, where I was her doula. And even with 2 years of therapy and a great insight, I mean, just some incredible self-reflection this mother brought to her birth, there was a point in the labor where she just panicked and held me close and said, this is my past. I'm afraid to push. This is my past. So what I would suggest is whatever method of healing mothers who are bereaved work through, I would hope it deals also with the body and memories that are in the body. It's one thing to talk through something and understand it intellectually, and bereavement support groups are fascinating and important and so helpful because you hear and see your own reflection and your story and others hold space for the suffering of others. At the same time, the body, we know the body and mind are linked, and the body plays a big role in our healing. And so using things like dance, yoga, walk, consciously using the body to open the doorways of health and wellness and healing. That one story of the mom I supported who had done so much work to prepare for her birth with me after this terrifying and difficult loss to two children, still had her in her body the memory. So when pushing came, she's like, I'm afraid of my past. So I hope that in addition to all the lists of support we can give, that the body is given a center place. We honor the body.
So Amy, as you had so beautifully put it when we first opened our show, you were talking about birth and death and how one is the entrance and the other is the exit to our physical bodies in this life. Can we leave the listener with some thoughts about the spiritual aspect of this entire realm?
It's a beautiful question. It's a question, I think, that points to the heart of mystery. We have so many approaches in the human experience that try to touch that love and that mystery. Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, the major world religions, and then the lesser known faith traditions, and each individual's understanding of how we're here, why we're here. I'm in this body. I wake up every day. This is such a gift. It really is such a gift, and it's short in the grand scheme of things. So when I think of pregnancy loss, there's this sense that this grief is so deep because that life didn't live the story that we hope for every human being, which is we hope for every human being a meaningful life where we see the stages of human experience expressed, you know, puberty, you know, adulthood, old age, and then death. That story is turned totally on its head with pregnancy loss for that individual child. And that's the spiritual mystery at work, and it's a deep one, and it's a painful one. So I don't have answers, but I rest in peace knowing that minds far greater than mine and hearts far wider than mine have made space for this pain and still affirm life's beauty. And if they can do that, then I feel I can have the courage to do that.
We've been talking with two women who have been impacted by pregnancy loss. We've learned about the distinctions, the impact, and some tips for healing. Amy Wright Glenn can be found at birthbreathanddeath.com and at Amy Wright Glenn on Facebook and Twitter. Elizabeth Petrucelli at Elizabeth, PetrucelliI.com. I want to thank both of you for just opening a window to this world, just even briefly. We could have spoken at greater length, but I really appreciate your input and your thoughts.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Sima, for making space in your show for this topic.
I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Thank you so much for listening to us today. And until next time, I hope you take care.